Hello and welcome to Prime Lenses. I'm Ian. Each week I speak to a photographer about three lenses that have meant something to them on their photographic journey. It's unashamedly gear chat, but hopefully focused more on the images made with that gear than performance metrics and graphs. My guest today is Kevin Mullins, a documentary and reportage style photographer. He's best known for his wonderful wedding photography, which is really candid and natural. His journey in photography actually only began about 16 years ago, and we get into that a little bit in the conversation. He's got a very human approach to his images, and he firmly believes that a photograph doesn't have to be good, it just needs to be important. This is a good one, I really enjoyed it. Here's my conversation with Kevin Mullins. How do we find you this Friday? How's it going?
Yeah, not too bad. Hectic week, same as you by the sounds of it, but yeah. Not too bad. Plodding on, good job as the weekend coming up.
Yes. Yeah. Although I guess weekends for you are sometimes quite busy, right?
Well, they are generally. Yeah. Although I'm really kind of pulling back on weddings now. So I've got four left. Next one's in May, I think. Then a couple in June, one in July. And that's it. And then I'm done. I'm retired from weddings.
Ah, right.
It's a very strange feeling. But
yeah, because it feels like that's the thing you're very known for. Like you seem to do, like in looking into like your portfolio and the kind of things that you do, like that seems to be the thing. Is that just like one day did you just go, I've had enough, this is the limit?
Pretty much, yeah. I hit 50 last year, and my plan always in my life since I was like about 18, I had like these plans, and 50 was my kind of semi-retirement age. So. So we kind of got to that, and things have kind of worked out all right. So now it's time to move on from weddings and do other stuff instead. So be nice.
Looking forward to it. That's nice. You entering a phase where you can kind of be a bit more picky and choosy with like the
I mean, I'll still probably end up doing a couple of weddings, but you know, so only like maybe friends, family, or ones that I really want to kind of cherry pick. But by and large, yeah, it's going to be mostly kind of training, workshops, street photography. I do a bit of commercial stuff. I've got a studio through the back door there as well to do some studio work. But yeah, weddings, you know, I've done well over 700 weddings in 16 years. So,
wow.
It's time to pull back on those for sure. It's definitely the right time.
Yeah, well, that's really good to hear that you're able to kind of move in that direction and sort of pick those projects a little bit more. Because one of the questions I was going to ask you later, but it kind of fits quite nicely now. How do you balance like what you do with the passion for or love for photography? Like, do you find you shoot more stuff on your own, and is that something for yourself, and that you something you'd like to make time for, or do you just want to make time to kind of be away from cameras and screens and prints?
No. I definitely still am a photographer, and I think mostly through my photographic life, at least. I think the biggest body of work I've got is personal photography, family, friends, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, that won't change, that will continue. But, you know, I really want to kind of do more long-term projects, you know, based around people, based around environments, based around circumstance, that kind of thing. So, and they won't be projects for a kind of financial reward or anything. They'll just be things that I want to do. Looking forward to that. But obviously I still need to pay the bills. So I still need to earn some money and, you know, pay the bills. And so I'll keep the studio here. I'll still do my workshops. I'll still do portraits. I'll still do, you know, the odd bit of commercial photography, all that kind of stuff. But I will definitely be doing a lot more personal projects, long-term projects, you know, that kind of thing. And that's what I've really always enjoyed. But never really had enough time to get my teeth into them.
Yeah. No, I suppose that can be there's so much breadth, isn't there, like to photography these days. I used to know a guy who shot MotoGP, and when he started, it was do the race, a bag of film, hand it to someone else and go to the pub.
Yeah.
And now it's, you know, it's everything. It's 20 minutes after the race is finished, PR want the perfect shots to put out as part of the press release. That all that development work, all that just sort of comes to you, and you end up diversifying into books and presets and kind of, you know, all of that kind of online stuff. But I've noticed you share quite a lot on your blog, and I guess because you do the workshops and things like that, like, does that come from a kind of a desire to kind of develop the skills in future in other photographers and sort of share this stuff?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I used to have a separate website which was called f16.click, and that was always my personal stuff and reviews, camera reviews, you know, kind of street photography, all of that stuff. And during COVID, I brought consolidated all my websites into one. So I now have that for photographers section on my website, which is basically all my personal photography, street photography, all of that kind of stuff, everything but weddings, effectively. Yeah. Right. And yeah, I've always done that. I've always enjoyed doing that. And, you know, I quite often get messages from complete strangers saying, you know, when I post a picture of my kids on Facebook or something, saying, oh my God, we've grown up watching your kids grow up. You know, we feel like we know them because I've shared so many pictures of them, you know, from the day they were born, and now they're like, Rosa's 16 now, you know? So, yeah, I'm still kind of keen to do that. They're less keen, obviously, having their photos taken, the kids. So, yeah. So that's kind of going away a little bit, but yeah, I'll still do the sharing. I'll still, you know, I've got plenty of things that, you know, I'm planning on doing with kind of more YouTube sharing, and, you know, I've got lenses and things that I still, you know, haven't managed to kind of do any testing with that I'll get around to do reviews for. And I feel like that's a good way to give back to the community as well. You know, obviously I do kind of make money from photographers as well, but primarily the content I share is, you know, is for free and is from an educational point of view, but also because I just enjoy kind of sharing work, really, you know.
It's a similar impulse, I suppose, to where these sorts of conversations came from for me. It's like, I want to get people just talking about photography and not, and I think there's a, I struggle sometimes to be optimistic about the future of what people think photography is, and or the loudest conversations about it, I suppose, on YouTube and on social media and things. And so I wanted to have some conversations with people who have done the work and have done, you know, it's taken them around the world. They can sequence images, they can put together a portfolio, they can put together a book, they can critique other images, as opposed to a lot of people who sort of, here's my street photography Instagram feed that just seems to be the back of a lot of people's heads. And, you know, it's odd.
I'm totally with you on that. And, you know, I feel like I also share that kind of concern about the future of photography, given the social media world we live in, and the insatiable appetite for people to, I think I call it digital vanity, you know, to having this, like, you know, kind of the currency of likes and the currency of followers and all of that kind of stuff. For what gain, what purpose, I'm not so sure. Of course, we all want to have a good following. We all want people to like our work, etc. But, you know, I think sometimes it's for the wrong reasons. You know, I see it in the wedding industry, especially. You see people who come in and their ambition is to be like an ambassador. And I always say to these people, look, you know, being an ambassador shouldn't be an ambition. It should be a reward. It shouldn't be something that you think, I want to do this, because it will force you to be too self-promotional, and it will, you know, just annoy your audience. And also you'll lose sight of the fact that actually the people that pay your bills are your clients, your wedding clients, in you know, from a wedding photography point of view. People massage their online portfolios because they think they want to get like a free lens or a free camera or whatever. And actually it's not good for business. It's not good for their business. You know? And so, that kind of thing is definitely endemic in the social media world with photography. And I do feel also like we have this bit of a tangent, but from a street photography point of view, you know, there's a lot of worry. People have a lot of worry, misplaced worry about privacy and posting pictures of street, and hence pictures of the back of people's heads and stuff. And, you know, they shouldn't have that worry, because, you know, if we don't take pictures of the front of people, how will people in 20 years' time know what the front of people look like now, right? So, you know, there is this whole kind of digital world we live in, whilst it's very beneficial, and I've used it and utilized it very well, it's also have, you know, it's a dilemma for some people also.
Yeah, I think it does lead to this kind of like homogenization as well of everything that gets viewed, that gets liked, ends up being very similar. So you never see anything that really surprises you. And all the conversations about gear, which was kind of where the idea for this came from, are around like perfection and graphs and how does this one perform versus that one? And this one's perfect. And, you know, like I shoot the Leica M system is my primary system. And I allowed a guy in a shop once to get in my head about how my Zeiss lenses weren't proper. Like it wasn't a good lens to use. And it's like, it's my favorite lens of all time, right? For loads of reasons. And it's not perfect. It's very far from perfect. But that's one of the things I like about it. And also, I'm not burdened by this being my job, right? Like I can just enjoy it. I can talk to other photographers about the gear. So I think we're sometimes doing it a bit wrong and doing a disservice and making people think they have to have a certain thing before they can even start, you know?
Yeah, 100%. And the tech stuff, you know, the appetite for people to want the sharpest, fastest, bestest, cleanest, you know, lenses wise, it's crazy. There was, I don't know if you saw the documentary on TV the other night about Tish Murtha. It was on BBC One. It'd be on the iPlayer.
Oh, right. Yeah, I've looked.
So any listeners who've got access to the iPlayer, there's a documentary about a wonderful photographer. She's dead now, but her daughter brought her archive to life. I've got the book actually. And it's all taken in like the 70s and 80s. It's just beautiful kind of real world documentary photography. It's all shot on film. It's all a bit soft. It's all a bit grainy, but they're the most beautiful pictures, and they are far better than most pictures that any of us will take these days, you know, and certainly the people that are spending their time worrying about whether a lens is perfectly sharp at the edges at F4 as well as F5.6. They'll never make the same types of pictures that Tish Murtha made, because she didn't care about that. She cared about what was in the heart of the photograph and the story that was in it, rather than the technology.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think it's the way you view that is clearly the reason that someone like Fuji would approach you for things like the Ambassador, stuff like that, because they can see the value of your work. When did that happen? How did that come about?
Well, that happened, blimey, we're going back into the mists of time now. I was the first ambassador for Fujifilm for wedding photography.
Right.
That would have been, I don't know, 2014, maybe 10 years ago, 2013. I purchased the original X100 when that was released. Mm-hmm. And at the time I was writing a monthly business article for Professional Photographer magazine, which no longer exists anymore. And they said to me, you know, you've got this camera. Do you want to do a review for us? So I was like, yeah, all right, I'll do a review. And I did a review. Shortly after that, Fujifilm launched the X Pro One and the three launch lenses, which were 18 mil, 60 mil, and the other one, 23 mil, I think it was. And once again, the magazine said, do you want to do a review? I said, yes. Then I started using it at weddings. I was posting lots of content about it. My website blew up because I was the only person using this new system for weddings. And eventually Fujifilm kind of said to me, oh, you know, we really like what you're doing. Can we use some of your pictures at what was then called Focus on Imaging, which is now the photography show? I was like, yeah, of course you can. Amazing. Brilliant. Go ahead, do it. And then shortly after that, they said, you know, we've got this scheme called, or we're bringing out this new scheme called X Photographers, which I thought was, I've always thought it was an odd name. X Photographers. I'm now actually technically an XX photographer. but they, you know, they said, do you want to get involved? And I was like, yeah, of course. What, you know, what does it entail? And they were like, well, we'll, you know, if we need to use your images for anything, we'll pay you for it. And perhaps you can get involved in, testing prototype cameras, that kind of thing. So yeah, did that, and you know, they packed me off to Japan for a couple of weeks to do some testing of cameras and talking about things, and workshops and talks, and yeah, I mean, it was an absolutely amazing experience. You know, went all around the world, and you know, been to Japan like 6 or 7 times, and it's been absolutely brilliant. You know, they're a great company, and I've had a great long-lasting friendly relationship with them. but very, it's a very symbiotic relationship. So, you know, even though I'm no longer an ambassador, I still, you know, promote their brand in a way, because I still use their stuff, and that, you know, and they know that, and they, you know, they've been very good to me over the years, and I've been very good to them. And if they want me to do stuff now, as has always been the case, they pay me, you know, that's the thing. Not to do a review or anything like that. That's always totally independent, but if they want me to do a talk at the photography show or something, then boom, you know, this is the rate, Kev. Will you come and do a talk for us? Yeah.
No, that's really cool. I think it's really nice to know that companies are using relationships with people who use their gear every day to get that real life feedback, you know, like, my day job is working in video games, and we'd be nowhere without feedback from real players, because you can test out stuff and thrash out stuff all you like, but until you put it in the hands of someone who goes, you know, that needs to be there, or this is too heavy, or this is too light, or, you know, things never move otherwise. So no, it's very cool it's that you've done that. It's really brilliant, which is a nice segue, I suppose, onto lens number one, because you, thank you for fully understanding the assignment. Some folks recently have tried to sneak in like four lenses, you know, just pick the focal length, but you've gone that 18 1.4 was the first one on your list. And looking at the images you shared with me beforehand when I was sort of doing a bit of research stuff, that's a workhorse lens. Like, that gets it done, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's the second iteration of an 18 mil lens from Fujifilm. So they did a kind of pancake lens originally, which was okay, but very slow to focus. Well, not very slow, but slower. And I must have had three copies of that lens, but they were so small that I just kept losing them. They kept just being left on park benches and things like that, I think. When the 18 mil 1.4, the current linear motor lens came out, I think probably 2 years ago now, it wasn't a focal length that I used much up until then. I was more of a 23 mil for my kind of medium to wide angle. But I got the 18 mil, I bought it. You know, I was an ambassador still at the time, but we still always bought our lenses. You know, it was the way it was. So I got that lens, and immediately I was like, wow, I really wish I'd been using this focal length for all of my work, you know, especially for weddings. Very sharp, very quick to focus, brilliant in low light, but wider than the 23 mil I had been using. So in full frame terms, for you, you know, for the full frame users, it's around about 24 mil in, you know, kind of that world. But 18 mil for me, and I had been using 23, which is around about 35. Right. So suddenly, you know, I have this new kind of vision of stuff, and it came around, it came along at the same time as the X-T5, I think. And the X-H2 cameras came along, which had 40 megapixel sensors. So of course that meant that even though I'm shooting wider with the bigger sensors, I had more crop in latitude. So I could still kind of, you know, be a bit cautious, a little bit conservative with my framing, but still know that I can do work with it later. And yeah, absolutely brilliant. I love getting really in close with it, you know, especially weddings, when people are kind of hugging each other and all that kind of stuff. It's amazing. It's just such an amazing lens. Nice and light as well. Not cheap, but, you know, really, really, that's the lens. I actually did a blog post a couple of weeks ago on my website that kind of outlined the lenses I use the most throughout 2023. And that was the lens that was number one on the list.
Yeah, no, it's good. I guess it's an advantage of that Fuji system in general. It's not massive, like physically. It's not, you know, it's quite, I've been always too scared to use the Fuji stuff for too long. Like, I've friends who've got it, and I've handled a camera and I've had a little go. The only Fuji we have in the house is an X10, is it? Yeah.
Which
now X10. My son runs around with and absolutely adores. He loves it. But I try and have a one camera rule, which I'm sort of trying to stick to, because otherwise, you know, and these conversations are going to be expensive, because I'm going to end up picking up the shelves behind me are going to fill up. But yeah, it's a part of the course. But yeah, that size and weight presumably is quite good, because you can get like a bag full of stuff and not be weighed down. Presumably you're shooting with like an X100 as your backup, or is it like a second, you know, camera? Or
so if I'm shooting weddings, I shoot with two X-T5s, one with the 18 mil and one with a 56 mil. The X100 or the X70, whichever one I've decided to take, usually goes in my jacket pocket, which is, you know, I kind of typically use, pull those ones out if I'm just a little bit bored throughout the day, or I want to do something a bit different, or, you know, I just kind of want to mingle a bit more. But the two XT5s, 18 mil and 56 mil, and that's it. I don't, I mean, believe it or not, I don't take a bag to a wedding. I mean, I do, but it's locked in the back of the car. I don't, you know, I have backup equipment and stuff there, but I don't, I just travel so light. I have one camera on a kind of hook on my hip, on my belt. Mm-hmm. The other one is on a strap. And that's it. And I just wander around all day with the two cameras. Batteries, they, you know, obviously I have spare batteries in my pocket also, but they don't need new battery. You know, one battery is enough. I use really large memory cards, so I don't change memory cards during the day. And it's really liberating. When I first started shooting weddings all those years ago, I literally would take, you know, like I was shooting Canon in those days, and very good system, but bigger and heavier. And I had all the lenses you could possibly think of, and I'd take them all with me, and I'd be swapping them and this and that. And then at one point, you know, I just kind of went, this is pointless. Why don't you just shoot with two lenses? And the benefit of that, obviously physically, the benefit of that is, you know, easier to shoot with on the day, but then, but it also brings a benefit from a client perspective, because the cohesion of the images they see is much clearer. You know, you don't have lots of different perspectives, and, you know, the everything they see on the website is taken essentially with those two lenses. So they can see in what they what they're going to expect to get with their pictures. So it was a win-win all around, really. I don't like carrying gear. I don't, you know, when I go to do street photography and stuff, it's usually just the X100 and the X70, and that's it.
No, you can travel super light, and they're so quiet and stealthy, those smaller cameras as well. I used to use the GR3 a lot, and it was the same sort of thing. It's like, it's unreasonable performance in a very small package. Even that X10, as old as it is, that's over 10 years old now. And that still, you know, makes a really lovely image, and it's very compact, and you can just sort of whip it out. And people don't react badly to it. Like, you're not shoving something in their face, like a massive, big, what, you know, the old traditional DSLRs and like the Canons with like the big white lenses, and people are like, whoa, what's that? I've seen those at weddings and stuff, or A7s seem to be more popular in the last few years. I never loved the color out of those. I always felt I was doing a bit too much. Had to do a bit too much afterwards, and it was only when I started using like the Ricoh and the Leica that I was like, oh, okay. You know, I think that first gen A7, I don't know this, but I feel like it came in a bit hot. You know, that first full frame, I feel like they were racing to get that thing to market in a way that certain things just had to go by the wayside. Like, it had to ship so that they could and it worked for them, right? They established a position, you know, on the interchangeable mirrorless front.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that, you know, not the vast majority, but, you know, certainly a majority in the wedding world, shooters use Sony cameras. You know, that's like the number one technology. And then I would say it's like your old school kind of Nikon, Canon stuff, and then Fujifilm probably coming in about fourth. You know, very, very loyal kind of user base, Fujifilm users. But from a wedding point of view, Sony seems to be, you know, the ones that people use, because they are, you know, they are faster to shoot with. They, you know, I've seen people, I've second shot with photographers who use Sony systems, and they're basically filming, you know, all day long, which, you know, I just don't shoot like that anyway, but for them it works. And so the Sony stuff is kind of winning the weddings, I would say.
Yeah, well, when you can do 120 FPS with like however many focus points active, like, you know, you're right. But then you've got to sort through all those images. Like, then one memory card wouldn't be enough all day. I mean, it's probably a bit risky. I tend to do like one or two shots and then I move on. Yeah. And I'm not looking at them. It's sort of like trying to, because I feel like that's where you get better. That's where you make progress, is that then you look at them with a bit of distance from the image. Because it can feel great when you're taking it.
And then, 100%. And if you're it depends what you're shooting, of course, but if you're a people photographer like I am, whether it's at weddings or whether it's street photography or, you know, family photography, whatever, you know, you've got to be very careful that you don't ruin a moment just by being there, you know. And you can certainly ruin a moment by overshooting and shooting through these things. You know, I've been in many, many situations where, you know, one photo is all I'm going to take, because I don't want granny to stop hugging the bride. You know, I don't want that to go away because she's suddenly conscious that I'm there with this camera. So I'll take one picture and I'll go and leave it. You know, and I often say to people, clients and students that, you know, I don't believe a photograph needs to be good. It just needs to be important. And, you know, you run the risk of really interrupting, you know, the fragments of time really by just being there and machine gunning through something for the sake of getting a couple of hundred extra likes on Instagram. And actually that moment is gone. It's disappeared. You know, it's like the postcards in Back to the Future, you know, when the people start slowly disappearing, you know, it's like, no, don't let things happen. Be very diligent and cautious about how you take pictures of people, you know?
No, you're absolutely right. I've had when you go to an event and people notice and comment, don't they, when someone's in their face. And not everybody is coming at it from the perspective of, oh, well, it's worth having this moment ruined so I get a good photo for later. Like that shouldn't be the objective.
It shouldn't be, but it is for a lot of people, you know, especially with social media. I mean, God, the horror stories, not so much photography, but, you know, people doing things for Instagram likes and reels and climbing God knows how high buildings and you know, and hanging off cliffs and all that kind of, and in the end they fall off and they die, you know, for the sake of bloody Instagram, you know. And I'm like, oh my word, what are you doing?
Dave Herring, who was a previous guest, did a video for a couple of weeks ago where he was in a part of, he'd driven out somewhere to get some photos of really old, like lovely old houses in America built in like the 50s and 60s. So they got these lovely kind of like flowing lines and sort of very, very cool, very Mad Men looking buildings. And he was shooting on film and he wanted to go look. And he saw some folks there who were like walking down the path to the front door of someone else's house just so they could get the shot of like a person looking back. And it's like, it's not their house. It's not cool to just drive up to someone else's house and photograph there without permission and just do it. And yeah, fine, you're in and out. And they might not even know you were there. But, you know, if that was what you wanted to do, go and ask, like go and, and maybe something more will come from it. But that's not the project that they're, you know, they're not talking about long form projects like you were talking about that you'll kind of do more of. They're talking about, like you say, post it to the gram, get some likes, do something, you know. It's the underpants gnomes from South Park. There's like a question mark in the middle and then profit at the end. That's that's what they're doing.
No, exactly. It's a weird world, you know, a very weird world. And I spend a lot of time in London and I see you know, people just selfie. I mean, maybe it's an age thing. I don't know. Maybe it's because I've hit that magic 50 and I'm just like, I don't know. But I feel like people, I don't know, they just live their lives in the little screen, don't they, of their phones, and they live quite often a fake life. You know, it's not all golden. We all know that, and real life isn't like that. You know, and I was saying to my wife, we were on holiday in Spain last year, and we went to this really nice restaurant, and it had this vista overlooking the sea, this little area where you can stand. And we were talking to my wife, and I was saying, look at all these people. And they were coming. They weren't actually even eating at the restaurant. They were coming and, you know, getting in the way of the people who were eating at the restaurant for a start. And they did this thing, which I call the Instagram walk, which is basically, you know, they give the phone to their husband, wife, boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever. They start recording and then they walk forward a few steps, then they throw their head over their shoulders, look back, maybe flick their hair. And then they run back to the camera, check to see if it was all right. If it wasn't, they do it again. And I'm like, but you didn't, that's recording something that never really happened. You know, you made a complete fake thing. And they were all doing it. Literally all of them. And I was like, get out my way. I want to see.
Can I have my dinner, please? No, it's very odd. It's a funny thing. I don't know if the last 4 years really helped either as well. Like, I spent so much time being cooped up and sort of the phone was all people had, you know. It was kind of like dark times. I'm fairly optimistic. I have to be optimistic, I suppose, that we'll kind of come out the other side and people, you know, broadly, there's going to be more people making stuff that's interesting than not. But yeah, you're right. The problem is that algorithmically, if that gets liked, then it kind of feeds the machine, and the machines are a little bit of a black box, really. Don't, you know, sometimes you don't really know why it's recommending the stuff it is, just kind of is. And we seem to be hurtling towards that, but you know, we are where we are. It's going to be fine.
Always is, isn't it? Yeah.
Sure. But you know, we can just be shouting at windmills in the corner. It's going to be all right. But yeah. So your second choice for a lens, while we're talking a little bit about gear, is a 56. I must admit, because this is a really nice conversation. I don't know the Fuji system well at all. So I feel like looking into them, this is a bit of a masterclass of like, this is all you'd need in your bag and you could cover a lot of ground.
Yeah.
The 56, what's that? Is that like an 85 equivalent, a 90 equivalent?
Yeah, it's something like 84.5 in full frame terms. Mm. And that's, again, there's a new version. So this is on the second iteration. But when that came out, I don't know, 10 years ago, I suppose, I got that lens as well. Because when I shot Canon, I shot 35-85. So when the 23 came and then the 56 came shortly afterwards, they were they were the same focal length effectively. The 56 mil, and it's a little bit bigger, it's a little bit heavier, it's a little bit slower to focus. But it's a little bit like that 85 mil 1.2 that Canon did. It's so beautiful, you know, absolutely beautiful lens, makes beautiful images, and it's f1.2 as well. So in low light, I don't use flash or anything like that for my wedding, so I rely on very fast lenses. It's a great lens for, making kind of environmental portraits, if you like, you know, popping, if somebody's popping out of the frame, get that 3D look to a scene. It's that was the lens that up until last year would have been the lens that topped my list of lens use each year. It's amazing. And I do feel like, just like you said then, you know, it's 56, 18, that is all you need. Obviously there's specialist lenses, you know, some people might need longer zooms, you know, if you're doing bird photography or wildlife or motorsports or whatever, you need specific things. But if you're taking pictures of people being people, basically living their own lives, then I honestly think you need a wide and a medium long range 56-ish. You don't need super 12 mils fisheyes, 140 mils. You just don't need that. If you think about the great photographers of the past, the social documentary photographers, they mostly use 35 mil and that was it.
One and done. I started with a 35mm 2.8 Canon MC. It was a point and shoot, but I think that's just baked into my brain that's what a photograph looks like, is that kind of that sort of view of the world, that viewport. What was the first one you picked up, that kind of that first camera, do you remember it?
Well, yeah, I do actually. When I became a photographer, which was 17 years ago, up until the moment I became a photographer, I'd never owned a camera. I had no ambition to be a photographer whatsoever. I was working in London. I got totally burnt out, picked up a magazine on the train one day, saw some candid wedding pictures, and I said to my wife, I'm going to do that. And she was like, well, you don't know anything about photography. You don't smile much. You don't, you know, you're just not going to be very good at it. So I did, at that point, I went and bought a camera, and it was a Canon Rebel, they called it Rebel T1 or something. I don't know.
I think they were TIs, weren't they? Yeah. Like my stepdad had like a 350 or something.
Yes. That rings a bell. I think Rebel was the American name for it, wasn't it? And we had normal numbers.
Yeah.
I want to say 300, but anyway, it was a small Canon camera. I bought a lens. I had no idea what I was doing with it at all. And that was the first camera I kind of had. I can't recall the lenses, though. The first lens I really recall as understanding and knowing what I was doing with it was the 35mm, I think it's an f1.4 Canon lens. And that was really nice. You know, that was really, really lovely lens. And again, this is, we're talking maybe 13, 14 years ago. And I remember going to, at the time I was playing a lot of rugby, and I I managed to get a pass to go pitch side for a Bristol rugby match. They were called the Bristol Bears now, but they were just called Bristol in those days. And I decided, because it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a paid gig or anything, I would just shoot everything on that 35mm lens, which meant that I positioned myself really close to the try line and just let, as soon as people got really close, I tried to get these frame-filling pictures. And it was great because it was a very different perspective to the sports photography you would normally see, which is taken on, you know, 600mm lens.
Yeah.
You know, and it was really different. And Bristol Rugby were like, we love these pictures. You know, can we use them? Can we put them in the program? And I was like, yeah, of course. They're like, can you come back and do it again? I was like, well, I can, but it's not an easy thing to do because you really do have to rely on the action to be happening right in front of you.
Mm.
You don't have the zoom lens or the long lens. So it kind of phased out a little bit, but I did love that lens. That was great.
Mm.
And my kind of love affair with that 35mm field of view. And I still think people say that the natural field of view, human field of view, is somewhere in a full frame world, is somewhere between 24 and 38mm. You know, that's what they seem to think. So I guess that's why a lot of people, I think, you know, you alluded to it yourself, are kind of attracted to that vision because it feels very normal.
Yeah. It also is a nice in between once you start to get into like different focal lengths, and it's like, you know, 35, kind of nicely in between. It's not as wide as 28, but you could sort of use it to make a portrait or a small group portrait in a way that you would more normally do maybe with a 50 or, you know, other ones like that to get that kind of compression. So it's nicely in between. My 35 barely leaves the front of my camera. And it was funny when I started these, I was expecting maybe a bit more kind of like 28, 50, 90 to be the kind of like the trinity that I would encounter a lot. And it's really funny. I've had some 20s, I've had 24. And it's just interesting to see how people use that, but getting up close and being in there and like with your subject and being either part of it because you're capturing something for yourself, or like in a wedding environment, I guess you just don't know how much space you're going to have around you. Probably not very much a lot of the time.
Yeah, you have no idea. And I guess one of the questions I get asked a lot is, going back to the 56, you know, what happens if you're at the back of a very big church or, you know, and you can't, you need a longer lens? And I just say, no, you don't. You just move your legs. You just walk a couple of steps forward. And that's it. You don't need it. You really don't need it. And I don't think I've shot longer than 56 at a wedding in probably 8 years. That's the longest I've had lens-wise. Yeah.
But I really like the way you establish those like group shots, like the shots. There's a few shots of yours that I really love around like people sat on the, you know, getting at the edge of the dance floor, getting the cake. And it's sort of, they've got that kind of like Renaissance painting feel to them of like a row of people and they're all doing kind of a different thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're all doing their own thing, but together, or the one of the people on the steps outside, almost waiting for the group photo, you know, just sort of stood around, and a woman in the foreground looking over her shoulder a little bit sus, you know. But that's real. That was the event. That conveys so much more than this sort of posed, perfectly shot.
Yeah. I mean, I market myself obviously as a candid wedding photographer, and, you know, it'd be disingenuous to say that we don't do any group shots, but rarely will I do more than three group shots. And mostly, you know, marketing works for me. So mostly the clients come to me, have no group shots. They don't have any formal. There's no bridal portraits, none of that. It's just candid fly on the wall photography, which is amazing. And it's a really enjoyable way of shooting. And, you know, it's quite a cathartic way of shooting, and there's no stress of group shots and formals and all that. So all of those moments in between, like you say, they're the things I'm looking for. I'm looking for the obvious stuff, obviously, you know, the first kiss, that blah, 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 walking up the aisle. Everything else, you know, the people that are looking at that, what's going on, little kid picking his nose, or, you know, granny taking a sip of a glass of wine, all of that kind of stuff is really what drives me. And I think that's why those two lenses, 18 and 56, are perfect, because I can work very close up and I can also be a little bit further back, but without being a paparazzi, you know, without kind of standing by a tree and just long range zoom, zoom, zoom. Because then you just get record shots of people who are there. They're nice pictures, candid headshots of people laughing, very nice. You know, I do them, of course, but there's not really any story with those. You know, yeah. I feel like you have to be going wider. There has to be context to the images, or at least a series of images, to bring a story together. And, you know, a wedding, just like anything, really, whether it's a wedding or whether it's a day out shooting on the streets, is it's about telling a story rather than, you know, that one individual image that's, you know, brilliant. It's a good thing. It'd be great if you can get that. But actually, for me personally, I prefer to look through a series of images and understand the context of it all.
Yeah, no, definitely. I feel like that's why things like portrait mode on phones are teaching people kind of the wrong thing about photography to some extent, because there's this assumption. So say, like, a Leica Q comes up a lot on these conversations, especially as like a second camera for people, because it's that really wide and it's got, you know, it's got a really wide aperture, 28 mil plus that 1.7. But there's an assumption sometimes, I think, from folks that like everyone's always shooting everything at 1.7. And again, because like those are the photos you see on Instagram with the like the really blurry background, the very sharp subject, that 3D pop that you're talking about.
Yeah.
But again, it's not telling a story other than like this woman was in front of a mountain, you know, or something like that. It's I don't know. It's just, and it's because it's baked into the camera people use the most now.
Yeah.
I think it's telling them the wrong thing. It's telling them that like everything should always be shot wide open. And actually, I don't want to go that low. Like, go and look at the National Portrait Gallery and the entries every year. So like the most interesting photos a lot of the time are the very, it's not a traditional portrait. It's a person in an environment.
Yeah.
And people forget that like a portrait is not just head and shoulders.
Yeah.
Shot on a studio background. You know, it can be lots of things.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And I love Natural Portrait, the Taylor Wesson Prize, when that comes up every year, I'll go and have a look at that, because I mean, there's some images that I look there and I think, oh my word, that's bizarre. But by and large, they are, you know, brilliant pictures, brilliant pictures. And you're right, there's, you know, the portrait mode on phones is a real weird thing, isn't it? Because it's digitally created, so it's fake blur for a start. And, you know, it has its place, of course it does, but yeah, you're right. You do see a load of pictures, especially on Instagram, where people have used portrait mode to take a picture of, you know, themselves in front of a mountain, for example, and you can't make out the mountain at all because it's just blurred in the background.
Yeah. No, I've never really liked it. Like, and I feel like with the current digicam craze, like the last person I spoke to was Ali O'Keefe, who runs 1 Month Two Cameras, and she's part of this kind of digicam movement, if you like, of like getting old cameras and using them and enjoying them for what they were, with the different, with the old sensors and the old lenses and stuff like that. And she does a lot of stuff about how there's no bad cameras. And I was talking to her, I feel like the kind of the next thing people are going to be grabbing is older phones. So like the phones from like 8 years ago, the Samsungs, which just cranked up the saturation and the color to like 1100 stupid, like, because that's the next thing that has a look. I think we're all kind of sometimes in search of film, like in search of that thing that because that's baked into it, it almost removes some of the need for you to have your own look. Cause you're like, well, this thing has a look. It has a, and so you're using the thing the way it wants to be used. I feel like the old phones are the next ones. Like once we run out of digicams.
You might be right. You know, it's the same with kind of vinyl records and all that kind of stuff, isn't it? No, but it does always, you said about film, and it always makes me laugh that, you know, and I'm as guilty of it as anybody, that we spend thousands and thousands and thousands on these pristine digital cameras, and then we'll put a preset on it to make it look like FP4 from 1965, you know. And I love all that. I do that all the time. I'm always editing my pictures to make them look more filmic. And actually, you know, there is merit in thinking, well, why don't you just buy a bloody film camera and, you know, and have it done? But of course, you don't have the luxury and the latitude. But, you know, it's like, it's nostalgia, isn't it? I think we have a hankering for nostalgia. Everybody does. And yeah, you're right. Maybe the old mobile phones will be the next craze.
Yeah, I think it might be. You're just trying to work out like what's the next thing that's got a camera in that no one's paying attention to, that sooner or later. I mean, even like I've got these glasses, the Snap ones, right? They have a little camera in them. And it's a very 2012, 2013 camera phone kind of sensor that's in it. Yeah. But on a really bright sunny day, And you do make these nice little magical hands-free images that are very much from your perspective. There's a real joy to them. They're really not, I mean, they're terrible quality pictures by, you know, like any measure. But that was there. And they kind of like, I get these moments of I've got the 3D ones as well that they did, which I think were even less popular than these ones. And the first time I watched a 3D video of my youngest on the beach, and I could watch it back in VR with little headphones in, and it was only maybe 20 seconds long. But it was like that bit in Minority Report. You're right back there. And the quality is terrible, but the frame rate's high. And so it tricks your brain a little bit. And just for a moment, you're like, I'm back on Saltburn Beach. And I'm with him and I can see this moment. And I think there's, you know, people are going to be looking for different perspectives and different viewpoints. I think stuff like this is possibly the next bit of the bargain bin that gets raided. And then suddenly you can't buy an X10 on eBay. We were given this by some friends, which was great because the kids wanted cameras. And I looked up, you can't get a decent condition X10 for less than £200. It's 12 years old. Like, what are we doing?
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, the Fujifilm X70 is the wild one, really, because that's they haven't made them in, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 years now.
Yeah.
But you can't buy one secondhand for less than at least 50% more than the original retail value. It's bizarre. It's bizarre. And then you think, why don't they make more of them? But they don't. There you go.
No, it's crazy. I just feel like it's a shame because these are the cameras that used to get into the hands of like kids and younger people or people just starting out, right? And if you cut off that avenue, if every one of them in a charity shop gets bought by someone who flips it on eBay, like good on them because they can. But no, it just, I know, it seems a shame. It seems like I'm missing a trick or they're missing a trick, you know, like we could pass it on. But anyway, so from old gear that sells for an overinflated price, your last lens is one that I was not aware of. But when I looked it up, lots of people saying like the sharpest lens ever and goes down to like 1.2, does it? The Viltrox 27.
Yeah. So the Viltrox 27mm is a reasonably new lens also. Mm. It is a 1.2 lens. And it's interesting for me because it's, in the APS-C world, it's a weird focal length. Mm. You know, it's just a strange thing. And I started using it late last year. So, I haven't used it anywhere near as much as the other two lenses. But I found it really fun to use. For a third-party lens, I think Fujifilm were one of the first manufacturers to open up their autofocus technology to third-party manufacturers in the mirrorless world. Mm-hmm. And so Viltrox originally had a handful of manual focus only lenses, and I had a few of them. And then they do the autofocus stuff. So this 27mm came along, and I was really intrigued by it. And it's got this kind of really milky focus acquisition as well. You almost can't feel it move in or focus in, unlike the Fujifilm lenses. It's not quite as fast to acquire focus, but it's kind of, I don't know, it's like a dreamy motion feeling. And it makes really, really kind of weird perspective but interesting images from a focal length point of view. The great thing about it, though, and the reason why I popped it on the list is because it's at least half the price of a Fujifilm official lens. Yeah. So I think it's great, you know, people to be aware of that lens because, you know, often we think, you know, if we're going into like Sony or we're going to Fujifilm or Nikon or whatever, that you have to buy all their lenses. And actually, that's not true.
Yeah.
You know, you can get very, very, very good lenses, you know, like the Zeiss lenses for Leica, all that kind of stuff. They're very, very good third-party lenses. You don't always have to invest hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pounds on the official lenses. So, yeah, I really like that lens. And actually, that's one that will be coming with me to most weddings, you know, jobs that I do going forward. It won't be my primary lens, but it will be the one that I kind of might pull out in the evenings for the dancing, for the partying, that kind of thing. Yeah. It's got a little bit better, not better, but a little bit deeper depth of field than the 18mm, but it's 1.2, so in low light, it works really well. Yeah.
Well, especially if you're not shooting with a flash and things like that, you need that. Yeah, you need to be able to see in the dark.
Yeah. And it's excellent. It's excellent. It's good rendering of the images as well, you know. And I don't really pixel peep, but I couldn't see any kind of distortions or any kind of flare or anything like that on it. It was, you know, it's a really, really nice lens. Yeah.
A lot of that stuff's so easily sorted in Lightroom anyway, like the any minor distortions and stuff like that. Like, you don't notice it half the time. And then, you know, you press the button and like a pincushion or a pillow effect is like slightly corrected.
Yeah.
I don't know how much stock to really put in some of that stuff anyway, you know, like.
I agree. For Fujifilm, we've had a bit of a luxury because the official lenses have all of that optimization stuff done within the lens itself. Okay. So when it comes to Lightroom, when you look at the profile, it just says inbuilt calibration. Yeah. It doesn't say this is this lens, Fujifilm lens, 23mm, et cetera, blah, blah, blah. So the Viltrox doesn't have that benefit. So you do need to switch that on in Lightroom just to correct everything a little bit. But it is marginal. There's nothing, you know, these days I don't even answer some of the questions that I get about, you know, is it still sharp at f/8 compared to f/5.6? You know, I'm just like, I don't know, and I don't care, and neither should you care, really. You know, don't worry about it. It just makes a really nice lens. It's a really nice lens. Viltrox are doing some really good stuff. I've actually got just here, I know that listeners won't be able to see it, but I've got the new Viltrox 75 f/1.2 as well in that box, which is big.
Yes, I was going to say it looks like a big box. I assumed it was like a camera box, not a lens box.
No, it's a lens. I haven't got it out of the box yet. It just looks big and heavy. I mean, 75mm f/1.2 is a lot of glass in that. But I'm looking forward to seeing how that compares to, you know, like the Fujifilm 90mm, which is...
More of a studio lens, that one, maybe.
Yeah, definitely. Not so much for out and about, but yeah, I'll see what it's like. And, you know, we've got... My daughter rides horses and stuff like that. So, you know, that kind of thing. I don't like getting too close to those big, horrible four-legged beasts. So that's something 75mm might be perfect for.
Yeah. Well, get back to Bristol to the rugby. You go and give the bears a shout. Like, look, got the kit.
Well, actually, nowadays I photograph for British judo. So, you know, I'm involved in judo, so I'm doing a lot of mat side photography for that now as well, which is great. But again, you know, it's very much, you know, we need pictures straight after the event for press, and it's not a great creatively. No. You don't have much latitude, but maybe I'll be able to do a little bit of stuff with it. Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah. Well, Rob, the MotoGP photographer that I talked to a couple of weeks ago, he does it. He manages to do a mix because he's freelance. He's not working only for a team. He works with riders and things like that. And so they want a mix. They want some track action, and that's what he's there for at the weekend. But then because he ends up getting picked up by the riders as well as the teams, he ends up doing stuff for them because they want it for their socials or for print or for, you know, for things that you'd sign at events, things like that. And so that's, I think, where he manages to balance the creativity. I mean, some of his photos look like paintings. They're incredible. Yeah. Like, I don't know how he's achieving that. And, you know, he's very willing to tell you if you ask him, but like some of it's just wild. And it's just a bunch of combination of like lights and lenses and just all sorts of stuff. He's really playing with it. Yeah, I love talking with people who use the stuff for reels as well, as opposed to like there's a definite difference between people who've spent 17 years doing it and people who've spent 17 minutes putting together a channel somewhere. You know, it's very satisfying to talk to someone who's actually done the work and had to like put stuff in their bag. Is there anything you want to kind of point people towards to find out more about what you're doing and sort of keep up with you in general?
I mean, they can, most of it they can find if they just go to kevinmullinsphotography.co.uk. You see all of the wedding work and family work, but probably for the photographers, there's a clearly signed for photographers link that has all my interviews, reviews, presets, workshops, training, all that kind of stuff. And then also I am on YouTube. Just search for Kevin Mullins on YouTube and you can, you know, get a look at my 50-year-old tired looking face occasionally when I talk about cameras and stuff.
look, I'm minutes behind you. So we'll just go off and shout at windmills and sort of worry about the state of social media together for the next for the next however long.
Thanks, Ian. I really enjoyed that. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. No, it was great fun. Have a great rest of Friday. Take care, mate.
Yeah, you too. Enjoy your weekend. Bye.
Thanks. Bye. You can rate and review this series on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and that'll help people to find the show. You can also sign up for a midweek newsletter that I've started doing. You can get that at ianfarrell.com/sign-up, and there is a link to it in the show notes as well. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.